So, welcome to the panel on how entrepreneurship drives social innovation. Before we start, just a quick update. In the email that you would have received, there is a link to this ebook called Starting Small and Making It Big. We encourage everybody to download and read the book. Thank you very much. On the panel we have today, Bill Cummings and Robert Orff. I will leave them to introduce themselves and then we'll start the panel.
Is this one now working okay?
Yes.
All right. So I'm Bill Cummings. I'm from Boston. And as opposed to our last speaker at the main theater, hands went up. Whoever heard of his company, and I think 98% of those present knew Shazam. If I said Cummings Properties, I suspect there's not anybody that ever heard of Cummings Properties or Bill Cummings. Oh, okay, before. Let me ask another question. Have any of you ever heard of the University of Global Health Equity?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay. All right. Here's the founder of one of the founders of University of Global Health Equity, who's now the director of the entrepreneurship program, Dr. Peter Drobeck. And he is the reason why there's a University of Global Health Equity in Rwanda. Cummings Properties is a commercial real estate firm in Boston that I founded about 50 years ago. And it, in turn, sponsored Cummings Foundation about 33 years ago, in 1986. We formed a philanthropic organization primarily to work in the local area around Boston, three counties. Essex, Suffolk, and Middlesex. They sound like three British counties, don't they? Essex, Suffolk, and Middlesex. And for good reason. The organization originally intended to work to fulfill the goal that my wife Joyce is over to my right, and I had to put money back into the communities where we got it. And there was no grand plan originally, but eventually we determined things were going so well that our kids had all the funding they needed for anything at all, and they were completely supportive, and we determined that most of the real estate that we'd accumulated, which is some 10, 11 million square feet of debt-free real estate in Boston, or outside of Boston, really, to be exact, in the suburban suburbs. And from that point on, Cummings Foundation became very important, and at this point the foundation has got a couple of $1 billion and it's probably benefited 1,000 not-for-profits in Massachusetts with average grants of more than $100,000 each. But it's something in the order of $225 million of actual grants. So we're brand new. We're in an organization that many of you would have heard of, the Giving Pledge, founded by Bill and Melinda Gates and Warren Buffett. And the story I will tell you there, we went to the first annual meeting and looked around the room, and there was a group that was somewhat similar in size to this, a little smaller than this. And we'd done pretty well by that point, and we looked around, and we were probably the poorest people in the room. So we were sure a little fish in a big pond by being there. But it was a lot of fun. We learned a lot. The other thing that happened while we were there was we ended up flying in. We flew into Arizona and took our budget rent-a-car down to about 100 miles out in the desert for a remote, lovely oasis of a ranch. The very attentive desk clerk came along, and so nice to have you here, Mr. and Mrs. Cummings. This is, I hope you had an enjoyable flight in, and said yes, and said welcome. We got all checked in, so one more thing, I need your tail number. And tail number. Oh, tail number. No, we came from the airport. Yes. But they had no idea that was the private plane. Everybody else came in their private planes. So we were the little fish in that pond for sure, but it's a great organization, and it's one that any of you who aspire to an organization like that, if you're is a great opportunity to learn from the things it publishes, and I found it that way. Certainly, we've learned so much from peers who know so much more than we do, for the most part. I think that I've got the distinction, as I look around, of probably being the oldest person I can see anyway, by a factor of two or three times, maybe, on average. This is what we are. We do philanthropy in Greater Boston, and that's the introduction, I guess. Is that good enough? Okay. Rob?
Okay. Is this working?
Yeah.
Okay. Great. So I'm Robert Opp, Director of Innovation and Change Management for the United Nations World Food Program. So the World Food Program is the UN agency responsible for providing food assistance for people in both crisis and long-term situations of food insecurity. So we are working in 83 countries, reaching between 80 and 100 million people a year with some form of food assistance. That is both in terms of physical food, but increasingly also in terms of cash assistance of some kind. And in fact, out of our $7 billion operating budget, around half of that is devoted to cash programs. We distributed cash in hand, about $2 billion to people last year. So the question is, why is, I guess, you know, a property magnate and an international public sector or public servant sitting here? I think what we have in common is that what we have been doing recently in the World Food Program, the last sort of 5 years or so, is looking to see how we can bring in more partnerships and more innovation, to partnerships to drive innovation, into the organization so that we can be as efficient and effective as possible. There are currently around 821 million people that are not getting the food that they need, the quality or quantity that they need. They're living in a situation of hunger, so that's 1 in 9 people on the planet are still affected by hunger. There are another 2 billion or so affected by micronutrient deficiencies. That means you don't have the right vitamins and minerals in your diet somewhere. All of that costs the world a tremendous amount in terms of economic potential loss, but more importantly, it's human capacity, human potential that is lost as well. And so the World Food Program works within the framework of the United Nations and the Sustainable Development Goals, one of which is to end hunger by 2030, so going from 820 million to zero in the next 13 years or so. So it's really, it's not 13 years. Well, I've been given the speech for a couple of years already. So. We don't have 13 years anymore. So we got to get going. And so one of the things that we are doing, in fact, is looking at how we can bring innovations in. And we see the startups and entrepreneurs as one of the sources of innovation that we can use and partner with to really get better at what we do and really try to find ways that leverage new technologies, new approaches, new business models that weren't available to us even a couple years ago for the work that we do. So we have created an innovation accelerator that's an in-house accelerator, which is very much like Y Combinator, Techstars, or some of these other tech accelerators. But instead of building equity of companies, we actually build the potential of ideas, and we match them with our country office on the ground network, and we really try to see which approaches work. So we've done everything that's sort of like low tech to high tech. On the low tech side, looking at basic hydroponic systems for growing fodder for animals, which after 7 days you can grow a sort of 6-inch height of fodder for goats to eat in the Algerian desert. On the high-tech side of things, we've got a functioning blockchain system that is supporting payments for 106,000 Syrian refugees living in Jordan. They're receiving that every month, and every month we're saving $40,000 as a result of the use of blockchain. We're looking at artificial intelligence, looking at biotech, all sorts of other things in between. But we are looking for the best ideas that are out there, so that we can bring them into the organization and hopefully make them successful to put against the problem that we're trying to solve. Yes, you need that.
Yeah. On the note, you know, Dheeraj mentioned this term tech for good. Can you hear me?
Just get a little closer.
Yeah. Dheeraj in his session mentioned tech for good. What does that word mean to you and WFP, and do you actually like the term tech for good?
I don't mind the term, but we don't, that's not, I guess everything we do is about ending hunger, so I guess if you call that good, that's good. but for us, we are simply looking for new applications that can be put against the problem we're trying to solve. So if tech for good is a categorization that helps people think of it in that way, I'm all for it. We don't necessarily need that. We're just looking for people who are interested in working on the same problems that we're interested in.
But in your book, Starting Small and Making It Big, you mentioned that you know you first heard the word entrepreneur in a French class and you felt very empowered by it. Can you talk a little bit about what the sense of empowerment meant for you and for the businesses that you run?
It was actually in my freshman and sophomore year at Tufts University near Boston that I did hear that word, and it was the very first time I heard it. Now, this is going back 60 years ago. That was not a word that was in common use at all in America anyway. Perhaps it was over here. There probably weren't many people in graduate courses learning about entrepreneurship in business schools. But to me, when I heard the word and heard it described what it meant, I talk in the book about how good it made me feel that there was a definition for who I was. I was going to, way back when, I'd preferred to have gone right from high school into working. I knew I always wanted a job. I always wanted to work for myself. But you really have to go to college first, Bill. Okay, I'll go to college first. And I happened to get lucky and I went to Tufts. And when I got through Tufts, I was all set to go and work for myself. But then, again, I had some counseling. You want to pick a major company first. I picked a couple of them. First was Vicks Vapor Rub. And that's as far as worldwide used product in those days, Vapor Rub was used everywhere. I had a 7-day expense account. I was 21 years old. I had just started out. I was on the road with a brand new car. I traveled from June 20th, probably, of that year until December 20, and never stayed anywhere except in a rental, a hotel or a motel. Completely able to bank my entire salary and got that start. So that in the salary and the fact that I didn't have to spend anything, I've become very frugal during that period. And I'll expand on the answer a little bit more than you asked me to here, because going back to the book, and have some of you had a chance to read it, book or download it? Okay, it is very readily available, and one of the things that I talk about in that book is certainly frugality, and the thing that is, and we heard talk in the keynote speech right after dinner about getting a credit card, and maxing out the credit card in 3 months, was it, and then taking 3 years to pay it back with great diligence, and how foolish that is to use credit card for credit, and just saving money. But the biggest thing for anybody who's getting ready for a career in entrepreneurship, and whether it's social entrepreneurship or entrepreneurship just to make jobs and make a living for yourself, if you're not going to enjoy it and not going to get some real pleasure out of the act of doing the work, probably shouldn't be there at all. It doesn't make sense to have that kind of a job unless you're really willing to put everything into it and really get something out of it yourself, other than, I'm the boss, I come late, I go home early, I tell people what to do and they'll do it. It does not work that way, guys. I had to get that message out anyway, just because you're all at the point where, or so many of you, I should say, are at the point where you're ready to do something and convinced that you want to, but you've got to go into it with the right attitude.
So, Dheeraj, you mentioned that you have a similar question, but little twist to that, because you support a lot of entrepreneurs. Could you talk a little bit about what are the qualities that you look for when you're supporting entrepreneurs?
I think Bill kind of just outlined it, actually. You know, one of the things that we thought when we started our accelerator was when we were talking to startups or putting challenges out there for startups and entrepreneurs to respond to, we actually thought the idea that they were bringing or putting forward was the most important thing. And then we realized, after a couple rounds of that, that actually the idea is important, but the team is more important, and the drive of the team behind it. And so, and that actually for us is the same whether it's someone coming from the outside or even whether it's an internal entrepreneur, because we have those as well. We have people inside the organization that want to do something innovative, they want to bring it forward. It's a type of social innovation that we're talking about. And again, it is the team and the sense of dedication that that team brings that is the critical factor. And so now, when we evaluate ideas or people, teams for inclusion in our cohorts, we look really carefully about that, and we really want to understand exactly how much time and energy and passion they are willing to commit, and how much time they are, you know, how they see themselves as a key ingredient in that picture.
Ben, if I can ask you a little bit more on the foundation in itself, right? So what were the triggers that pushed you to set up the Cummings Foundation in 1986? And whereas from where it was in 1986 to 2018 and 19, how has it evolved?
The way it's evolved really has been with the lifestyle that we've chosen to lead, which has been a lot of work involved and a commitment to that, and then a gradual separation from the business side of things, which is it's a company that's got 360 or so employees that operate this real estate in Boston in eastern Massachusetts, and getting to the point where I'm working on the foundation almost all of the time, and I so much enjoy that now and have the opportunity to give back, but we're so much moved by the need to do something with the funds that we've acquired. And Cummings Foundation, it does not have a sunset clause to it. In other words, there's no plan to have it cease operations 10-20 years after the last of us leaves the earth. I hope it'll be around for a long time to come. I expect it will. It's the type of thing that we're trying very hard to set up a program that makes it sustainable in its own right for many years to come. We use an extraordinary number of volunteers. Cummings Foundation has one full-time employee and other people who work for Cummings Properties who manage the affairs and do the administrative work at no pay to the foundation at all, to the company from the foundation. And we have 83 or 84 mostly retired people, or people who are thinking about retiring, who've got some spare time now, who are former school teachers or a hockey coach maybe at the junior high school, or there have been several college presidents who actually make the majority of all the grants that come from our foundation are made by these volunteers who have been with us now for some of them for 5 or 6 years, and they do the evaluating, and it's very it's a very interesting process. It almost could be like the rings in this room. The outside area, you've got 500 organizations applying for a grant, and then it's reduced very quickly and easily down to the smaller size ring. And then you've got come down in the end to 200 organizations that are selected completely by the volunteers. We'll select 100 of the winners. And they have a very hard time doing it. But they know that all of the candidates at that point are probably well qualified, and they can't make a mistake. So they go into it with that. That's the thing that they rely on, that there's no oversight, there's no second guessing the committees. when they come up with the names of the winners, and each of these winners will get a $100,000 grant over a period of typically from 2 to 5 years. And some of them will be even over a 10-year period. I'm talking about an after-school daycare that's run at the nearby temple or something, or a hunger feeding program that feeds dinner every Thursday night. Low-key organizations that don't have a whole lot of budget, strictly work with volunteers. And the opportunity to select which of these groups receive the funds is really fascinating to see how it works. They get extremely wrapped up in it, and they do a far better job than we could ever think of doing if we were going to go out and try to hire enough people to evaluate these 600 applicants. It would be a horrendous amount of work, and to do it every year, the same thing. The volunteers love it. It's terrific.
The unique thing about Cummings Foundation is that most of the grants is localized, right? If you look at other Giving Pledge members or other philanthropists, most of their giving is outside. They give it to Africa, India, and different parts of the world. So could you talk a little bit about what was your drive or motivation behind giving grants to where you actually run your business?
When we first started out, the idea was to do all of our philanthropy locally because that's where our funds came from. And then we met Dr. Paul Farmer, who some of you will know from Partners in Health, who was Peter's former close colleague at Partners in Health. Then we met Peter when we made a trip to Rwanda to see what was happening there. We became very involved in the concept and proposed the concept of this new university, actually. And we set it up with a proposed grant. It was a matching grant proposal that we would put in $15 million, if Partners in Health would raise the other $15 million. Well, they didn't get around to it in time, so we went out and we took a ride out to, with one of our trustees, I took a ride out to Seattle and met with Gates Foundation, and Gates Foundation matched it for us. So that's how we got started, and that's how the matching grant came about. But that's completely outside of our stated area, but things have to change. We went into it thinking one thing and dramatically changed what we did. We made a grant of a couple million dollars the other day to a new, not too new, but in Burundi, the Global Health Village? No. Village Health Works. In Burundi. So we've already gone again, we've changed that again. So things have to change. You always want to be ready to change and reconsider and adjust whatever you do in life that way. I mean, you can't get stuck on something because you learn more, you get smarter, you make different decisions. So that's where we started, though.
Robert, a similar question. With WFP, a lot of your entrepreneurs work are trying to solve problems in different parts of the world, in Africa or different parts of the Middle East and Asia. And these entrepreneurs actually don't come from those areas, right? They have not lived the problem. And that's something that we constantly, even in the business school, encourage people to live the problem that they're trying to solve. So how do you, in your selection process and in your mentoring process, how do you ensure that the entrepreneurs understand that they're solving for something that they have not lived through? And how do you sort of mitigate some of the unintended consequences that
would
come from something like that?
So the first thing is that some of the entrepreneurs do come from those areas. We try to find local startups that can work locally, but that doesn't always happen. So I think it's fair to say a majority come from another area, whether that's sort of local in the region or internationally. I think the issue is that the way that we try to set things up is so that there is actually this sense of partnership. And the reason that we have, for example, the World Food Program with 83 country offices and 17,000 staff members, probably the deepest field network in the UN, among the UN system, but perhaps among almost every humanitarian organization. What we bring to the table is that set of connections with local communities, a local understanding of context, and all of that. So it's important when we bring entrepreneurs or startups into the organization as a, you know, kind of in our accelerator or whatever the engagement is, it's really important that we're immediately trying to match them with the local context. So what we'll do in the accelerator, if we bring someone in for one of our kind of early stage support programs, which is a 5-day intensive program, we will already bring somebody in from our field network to work with them and make sure that that solution that they're working on is really fixed or stays focused on the problem that is actually hitting the ground. Then if we choose to work with that group, that startup afterward, we actually just take them straight to the field and we use basically human-centered design and, you know, lean startup and, you know, all the kind of startup-y type stuff, right? But the bottom line is that it's common sense, stay focused on the problem you're trying to solve and stay focused on the needs of the user. And for us, the user is the woman, the child, the man in the local context affected by hunger or some challenge of some kind. And so any solution that we're working on jointly with any startup has to be iterated over and over again with that in mind. So that's why the way we're doing that. But, you know, I'll say that what we're doing is still somewhat experimental. And just as Bill said, you can't stay fixed on this. So you've got to kind of watch what works and what doesn't work, and then next time do it differently. So the first couple rounds, we didn't have anyone coming in from our field offices. We realized immediately that was a major shortcoming because people would go spinning off in a totally different direction, because if you're coming from Silicon Valley and you're trying to work in Tanzania and you've never been to Tanzania, I mean, it's impossible. So you've got to find ways to bridge that right from the beginning. And we thought it could be later, but now we do it right at the beginning.
Just a follow-up question on that. How do you get, or what processes do you have to push your entrepreneurs to listen or, you know, understand the needs of the community you're working with?
It's mainly, like I would say, it's an insistence on user-centered design, right? So, and again, we don't need to get jargony about it. It's pretty basic and common sense, but we actually insist on very fast iteration cycles. So if you're working on, I'm trying to think of an example offhand, but even like, we've been working on several mobile-based virtual market platforms. So for small farmers to be able to buy agricultural inputs or actually sell their food that they produce virtually, so that really makes it much more efficient for them. If you're a small farmer in lots of parts of sub-Saharan Africa, to go to market with your food that you've just grown for that season, you don't know what the prices are, where you're going to go. You probably have to pay for transport to get you and your food there. So you're really at the mercy of random chance. And putting it on a virtual platform, a digital platform, can be a way of matching the buyer with matching the buyer with the seller in a much more efficient way. But developing those systems, if you're using a cell phone or smartphone platform, you've got to have the understanding of, okay, how literate are the people you're working with, the small farmer, what do they really need? Because you can sit in any capital of the developed world and think about what would be useful, and oh, let's put weather information on, and let's put, you know, some AI-based plant identification disease thing, and let's put, you know, but until you go down and actually develop the wireframe, present the farmer with it, sit down and talk about what it is that challenges them on a daily basis rather than challenges you, you're going to miss the plot. So it is really, and it's when anybody that we work with, we insist on that as being a core of the process.
Then if I can ask you, because you support a lot of small, relatively unknown organizations, how do you manage any kind of reputation risk for your foundation, if at all? Any?
Which risk?
Reputation risk. Reputation in terms of...
Reputation risk.
Sorry,
that can be a problem. And there have been a couple of times that we've come very close to being embarrassed. One time when the organization that was about to get the check The check was returned by the post office, and he said, "Ooh, aren't we lucky? You know, that it already moved out of town." But that was the closest we ever came. And it had moved to it. It was no longer a Massachusetts entity. It was now a New Jersey entity. And we try to be extraordinarily open and diverse, extremely diverse in all sorts of different ways. I should comment, too, by the way, Rob and I had a bit of a chance to talk with you earlier this morning, and he made the point, and I heartily concur, that this session has to do primarily with social entrepreneurship, and both of us feel very strongly that entrepreneurship of any description is good, and that people should be drawn to it, because in my mind, the most important thing really is creating jobs for other people. That's how I think of it, anyway. The jobs that are created, as well as the dollars that are put into the community. So that's a very important part of it, I think. I neglected to chime in on that one before.
Do you want to talk about
it? Yeah, I mean, we had a great discussion about that. And the point for me is that it's, we don't look for people who come and say, "Oh, I'm a social entrepreneur." I mean, you're an entrepreneur. And if you want to work with us, we have to align our interests and what we're trying to achieve. That's the most important thing. I don't really care if you're a self-declared social entrepreneur or if you've got impact investments behind you or whatever. It's just alignment of interests and what is good for the people, in this case, that we're trying to serve those affected by hunger. In the case of the World Food Program, and for others, it's going to be different interests. So it's just the... I certainly don't mind people using that label, social entrepreneurship, because it's helpful to kind of stake a claim against something that you're less sure about or that you consider as unethical or something, that's fine. But for us, it really is a non-issue.
So if you can ask the same question about reputation, so how does that, has it ever affected WFP?
Okay.
Going too much into the aid part, but more on the accelerated part.
Well, we have, there's lots of risk, there's lots of risk. So, one of them is pretty basic. You know, working in something like blockchain, we get lots of people asking questions about. Are you using an immature technology, and how dare you experiment on poor people and all this kind of thing? Well, the reality of that is that notwithstanding the fact that our blockchain system has actually survived 3 security reviews and is more robust than probably any other corporate database that we have, it's just that we understand that there's a sensitivity around new technologies. My view is that new technologies that have a lot of potential benefit should not be subject to trickle-down only in terms of starting in the sort of the rich and developed world and then eventually trickling down when the costs lower and all that kind of thing for the people who are most vulnerable. I actually think we should be working on business models now to translate those technologies as fast as possible, because arguably they have a lot more to gain from the benefits of technology. A small farmer being able to triple income because of a virtual market that they can sign up to is a lot more important than me getting my groceries to my door an hour earlier than I did, a year ago or whatever, because someone's worked up to optimize that innovation. So it's, I think that's important. But the other interesting risk that we see now is because I should say, our innovation, it's not just focused on technology, but you see a lot of these systems underpinned by technologies. And as humanitarian organizations, working with the most vulnerable people in the world, as we have moved to digital systems, it means that we are collecting more and more data, and the issue of data privacy and data security is coming really quickly. Probably our adoption of the technology outpaced our kind of thinking around how to ensure that we have the full kind of policies related to privacy and data protection. What I mean by that is not that we put people's data at risk. It's just that we didn't. We were just rushing to solve an operational problem, and now we realize, oh, we've got to catch up on the side where we make sure that when we collect people's data, because we're the custodians, we've got to be really sure we're taking care of it, because this is there's a little more at stake again. Like, you know, the world has been shocked, or the West has been shocked by, you know, Equifax and, you know, all the kind of high profile data breaches that have, we've all felt betrayed. But these are people who are just, you know, this is their only entry into the digital world, and it's they are living in a situation of potential persecution and high vulnerability. We have a super obligation to make sure that they are very, very protected when it comes to their data and everything else in their lives.
In the interest of time, we can open it up to questions in the audience. Do anybody?
Yes, so just a couple of questions, observations. Firstly, there's a really good question there about how you sort of land in your teams in the areas. I thought that was really good in terms of, I'm not sure if you're aware, there's been some controversy this week around you made with Stacey Cooley and David Lammy and Comic Relief. Are you aware of it? It might be worth sort of having a look at what's happening until you get part. My question actually is related to that. It's regarding sustainability. So I do quite a bit of work within the communities within Oxford, and always there's challenging areas within Oxford, and Oxford has got some. It'll be the same challenging areas for 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and will be the same challenging areas in 10 years' time, but hopefully we'll make a reverse on that. And almost all the work you do, I have a real question around sustainability in terms of, you know, how are we going to make that monumental shift? So we're not talking about it in 10, 20 years' time.
Sustainability, yeah, so yeah, when we work in food systems issues, you know, looking at hunger and looking at food, it is important to remember that around 30% of CO2 emissions are actually being driven by the agricultural and kind of food systems industries. And so when we look for new solutions, it's not just about increasing food production for in the same way. We've got to look at more creative ways to do that. So sustainability for us, we've looked at different kinds of things. It's not a, how would I say it, for us in our mandate, it's got to come as a secondary kind of thing, not in terms of priority. But what we mean is our primary outcome that we're looking for is reducing hunger, but we know very well that doing that in the same way we've done it before is actually not going to be good for the overall planetary health. So we're looking at like energy efficiency in installations. We're looking at you know, the hydroponic area of production is really interesting in terms of water efficiency and things. So sharing economy approaches to agricultural equipment that we think has us positive impact on sustainability. So yeah, there's a number of things that we have to keep in mind for sure.
Hi. So you know, my question is around a lot of inventions happening in via uneducated rural entrepreneurs. They really come up with some of the inventions which are really groundbreaking, but what happens is that those inventions don't become innovations. They lack the business viability, the financial viability. How do you think that gap can be plugged?
You take the tough ones, Rob.
it's an interesting question, because right now we are actually working with Stanford University and Rockefeller Foundation on a new kind of financing facility that ideally would be able to bridge some of that gap. Now, I say ideally because it's still in design phase and we're looking at it, but the pre-seed and kind of seed level of financing is very difficult. And even before you get there, I think what you're talking about is kind of like on-farm invention and creativity that doesn't even get shaped into a kind of a business yet. And that's really tricky. I'll be honest, currently we don't have the ability to work quite at that level. I think what we've been working on with this financing facility would be able to start picking those kinds of innovations up at the pre-seed level, if you've kind of got a little startup together, and try to accompany it kind of up the scale. So in other words, we know it's a gap. We're trying to address that right now, but we're just not there yet.
Yeah.
So one of the questions for you, from a philanthropy perspective, do you look at any potential grant recipients as a business, in the sense of, while there might not be a financial return, do you look at things like, you know, how sustainable is it, and if you manage to, I guess, turn over the investment, I mean, it's hard because it's not a financial investment, right? But if you manage to turn over the investment, does the return go back into the same business? I don't know if you understand what...
I think I understand fine. But remember that we're not making investments other than one-way investments. And we're not looking for an organization. We're thinking much more about sustaining an organization. Our principal concern with the smaller organizations with which we work is that in most of them, they've got an executive director, or may not even call it that, a manager or a director, who spends most of his or her time, if not almost all of it, in fundraising, and barely has the time to think much about the program itself. Volunteers come in and hopefully do that. So we're trying to have organizations where our grant is meaningful enough, there might be only, you know, three or four or five, half a dozen paid employees in the group. We very strongly avoid, in Boston, places like the Museum of Fine Arts or Mass General Hospital or Harvard University, or places that have got, you know, far, far more funds than we do. There might be a specific program, one of them being genocide, that we work with quite a bit, the Holocaust and genocide. And indeed, it was the Rwandan genocide that got us first looking at Rwanda in the really early instance of the horrendous conditions there. But it's sustainability for the organization itself to try to have it know it's got certain finances coming in without having to go pound on the door to get it every year. And we would anticipate being with many of these organizations over an extended period of time, by dozens of years.
So there's that stat, I think, where it's 9 out of 10 new businesses fail. Do you think that social enterprises are put to a high standard, given that their audience, you know, they need food? If your enterprise fails, you go hungry. And if so, what is that standard based on?
So do I think social enterprises are held to a higher standard?
Like, the mistakes are forgiven more, is
what you're saying. Or they're given more chances so they don't fail.
Right. well, at the moment, I think that, social enterprises are those, you know, kind of startups or enterprises that are trying to do things that have a social impact as well as a financial one. Okay, I think they're likely to get access to more concessionary capital, for one. And actually, talking to some of the entrepreneurs, that's seen as an advantage and a disadvantage in some cases as well, because that concessionary financing, that kind of grant funding in some cases for a business, can be a source of, how would I put it delicately? I've actually spoken to some startups who've said, we actually don't want grant funding anymore because it actually makes us a bit, I don't think lazy was the right term, or the term that they used, but it was like something like that. So, but in terms of held to a higher standard or given more chances, I think in some cases, because there's a lot of interest in working in that space right now from some of the kind of public sector players or foundation players, that are really looking for demonstration examples. I think if you've got a really shiny example, you can actually get a lot of money without actually achieving a lot of results. And so I actually think that is a pitfall that we need to be careful of in this emerging trend right now. I think we really need to hold people accountable for results, both socially and the financial results.
Back on exactly what you just said, I was thinking these social enterprises and non-profits, there are often scandals about big CEOs grabbing power, grabbing money, and very little actually reaching the people that need it. And I have spoken to people that have worked in this sector, and they have said, yes, we're really good at writing how much change we've made without actually having made any change. So I personally am concerned when I'm giving away to organizations. I prefer to take a different approach, and I think that that is a worry for many people when they're putting their money and trust into organizations that go busted months or years later with huge amount of money being kind of just taken away and stolen from the actual causes. So how do you ensure that you have transparency and that people can literally see where your money are going and how you're spending every penny? Because I think that's a prime thing if you want to ensure that you would be doing what you're saying you're doing. How do you ensure that transparency?
Bill, that's a tough one for you to start with.
Well, let me just say that in our case, one of the reasons we stay as local as we do most of the time is just that type of concern. And if I were Rob, I think I'd have bad dreams some nights and things that could happen that may never be anywhere near happening. I will tell you that before we went to Rwanda the first time, I felt very fortunate when Joyce and I had a chance to, at that meeting I described before, the one in the desert in Arizona, to talk with Warren Buffett about what was going on in Rwanda and how realistic was it to be going into this place which only, you know, less than two decades earlier had these terrible conditions, and was so relieved to find that the assessment that they had, and knowing that the type of realistic knowledge. They knew what was going on in that country. I mean, they had lots of good frontline intelligence from their staff people who were there, and the resources that they had that made us feel very good with some of the stuff they shared with us. So that there it could have been on a national basis, because there were 800,000 people plus, you know, who died in a 3-month period. So there's all kinds of things could happen in that country. But the type of leadership that had come into power still was capable of dealing with something like that. They were a different type of people, but did just a magnificent job, and they still seem to be. But we didn't know that, but being able to get that information ahead of time was very good for us, and that's one of the advantages of that particular organization, is that they share that kind of information to avoid the problem that you're describing sometimes.
I would just add that, as World Food Program, there's a whole, you know, and your same question also applies there, but as a public institution, we have, you know, more rules than I'd like to admit about transparency, accountability, and showing results. But when we work with others, because, and I should explain, we're not able to take equity or give financing to startups. We actually give grants, because that's actually, as a public sector organization, we were not set up to actually receive any returns. So it's about, we would receive contributions from our government donors, and then we would get some of those that have been used to set aside for innovation. We're giving small grants to these kind of companies. One of the ways that we get around what you're talking about is we actually start really, really small with them. So we give very small grants to start with so that you're not actually putting out a lot that is at risk there materially. We obviously do due diligence checks, and we have, you know, contractual procedures and all that kind of stuff. But it actually comes down, I think, again, the fundamental of what Bill is saying is that it really helps when you know them. So you've got to get to know them, and you've got to understand what kind of organization it is, and you've got to then go from there, and you start small.
But if that's you, that you're pledging for money, how do you convince? So if you want to sit in front of a bunch of people that can actually give you money so you can do the good stuff, how do you convince them? And how do you show your transparency in the company to basically demonstrate that you will do what you're promising with these money? How do you get the trust of others? It's one thing to be giving to others and obtaining their trust, but how do you achieve the trust for yourself and for your company?
Are you actually asking about the World Food Program?
Yeah.
I mean, our trust comes over 70 years of history, and the public reporting that we're held to, we have a governing board of 36 member states that demand ultimate accountability for us, from us, for every dollar that is provided to the organization. So when we fundraise with individuals, like private donors, we can demonstrate the same level of accountability and transparency. And we can go beyond if we want to. So it's about demonstrating individual evidence, and project by project, we can demonstrate evaluations. And actually, one of the things we're working on as an innovation is how do we get better and more digital at that, so people can access data or see dashboards and things about what it is we're doing worldwide.
Question for Bill. Bill, you became a philanthropist because you had the financial backing. If organisations don't have that financial backing, but they wanted to apply similar practices that you practice, what advice would you give them?
I think the practices would be just fine either way. And the financial backing is the money that we've earned from commercial real estate, and simply determining that we want to then give that real estate away, that we want to no longer own it. That money is then transferred over. Effectively, it goes directly into the foundation. We don't take anything at all from the foundation. The real estate is all debt-free. That's heresy, I guess, in a major business school to talk about debt-free real estate. It should be all, it's all leverage, isn't it? And you know, the idea of personally guaranteeing a note, guaranteed every loan, when we were taking out mortgages on property, if I got a quarter point off by personally guaranteeing, I didn't tell Joyce, but I certainly was happy to take the quarter point off. There's one major person in the United States that you all heard about who wouldn't ever think of personally guaranteeing anything except anybody's own risk. But I never chose to go that route. And so we don't borrow, and we don't, and we will still personally guarantee something if necessary. But I think the model works with the volunteers either way. I don't think that makes too much difference. Another thing, since I've got the mic, is to tell you that we have a company that's behind the foundation, and everything it makes, it puts into the foundation. And one of the things that we do that I have found to be extremely appreciated is to have not only a matching gift program for our staff, and we have one, but in addition to that, every staff member in the company, and in a couple of assisted, not-for-profit assisted living communities we have, but more than 500 people all together get to give $1,000 or $2,000 of the company's money as their involvement. So they're making donations then, which are, you know, far above what a, you know, typical carpenter or plumber or housekeeper is ever going to make. And they often will structure them as family decisions. What are we daddy's got or mommy's got $1,000 to give away, where should we go with it? And they'll make a joint commitment and a joint delivery of that check, and it goes over extremely well. So these are the people who are putting out every day and every week to provide the funds and to provide the services that create the funds. And that's so much appreciated. So if you've got an entrepreneurial venture and you want to get your, at whatever level, your colleagues, that type of an operation so they can give some of your money away on their own recognizance is extremely well appreciated.
Just to add that question, at the Sunny already gave away around 200 million grants. So I just
we've given grants in excess of 200 million.
Yes. So I just want to know the initial reaction of your children when you decided to give away your work.
We have four children. They have different needs and different positions. All four are completely supportive. So we have no schism in the family. No. And everybody speaks to everyone. And they're totally supportive. They're not involved either in the company or the foundation, but one of them is learning disabled, but the three who are not all have expressed interest in becoming involved as their careers reach whatever level they're going to reach. And so fortunately, you haven't heard any stories I haven't heard, Joyce.
Have
you?
So we have time for one last question. Okay.
Yep. You mentioned something at the beginning saying that there's still about 800 million people who are hungry. What are we missing to achieve the goal to get them to zero? What do you think?
That's the last question you're going to ask. there's not a simple answer to that question, but it's going to take a lot. I mean, one of the things that, it's going to take large-scale policy changes and good governance and, a lot of stuff, better systems of resilience for small communities, which we're working to support. It is going to take innovation. That's certainly one of the levers. Ultimately, though, let's face it. It's going to take the aligned will of a lot of different players together, pushing in the same direction to do this. And there's zero reason why hunger needs to exist among humanity right now. I mean, if the world decided to just take care of this, like if everyone kind of got aligned, and it's not just a matter of writing a big check. It's if we just aligned our kind of willpower, it would get done. And so there's got to be advocacy around that. There's got to be all of that kind of stuff come together. One of the things about all of the Sustainable Development Goals right now is that the 17th out of 17 Sustainable Development Goals is around partnerships and how we recognize, the member states of the UN recognize that ending hunger, ending poverty, achieving gender equality, all of the Sustainable Development Goals are impossible unless we have these coalitions among all the sectors. So it's government, non-government, private sector, civil society, etc.
So on that note, let's wrap up. Please join me in thanking Bill and Robert.